From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It may not surprise you that Richard Nixon was given to temper tantrums. Actual tantrums, flailing his arms and legs, taking swings at people. He threw an ashtray across the room when he learned about the Watergate break-in. He would rage against the press and Jews and liberals. But there was another part of him, too, says the journalist and historian John Farrell. A sharp analytical mind, the sense of generosity. He could be subdued and morose, plagued as he was by self-doubt. So there's the Nixon who violated the Constitution and the Nixon who signed the first nuclear arms treaty with the Soviets and went to Beijing and created the Environmental Protection Agency. John Farrell has written a biography of Nixon. He's joining us today to talk about the many complicated parts of the man. Join us after the news.
Love what you hear? Radio West podcast is made possible in part by thousands of KUER sustainers, along with Albion Financial Group, wealth advisors since 1982. Albion values local organizations helping to enrich the community through the power of ideas. Find out more online at albionfinancial.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. John Farrell didn't write a book about Richard Nixon because he wanted to compare that president with the new one. He had been working on his biography long before Donald Trump or this latest brand of populism became a thing. But when the book came out recently, he acknowledged the timing and the parallels between that time and this, if not the men themselves. A break-in at the DNC headquarters, hundreds of thousands of people marching and protesting in the streets, an attorney general resigning over principle, allegations of wiretapping, and a war declared on the press. Today in the program, a conversation with John Farrell about his book. It's called Richard Nixon, The Life. Farrell is a longtime journalist. He's the author of several biographies. When we began the interview, Farrell asked me how old I was. 52, I told him. So, not my target audience, he said. Farrell says he wanted to write a book about Nixon for younger people who didn't really know much about who Richard Nixon was or what he had done.
I wrote the book for those who weren't around when Nixon was. Yeah. It's an amazing statistic, but about two-thirds of today's population were either not alive or not living in the United States when Nixon resigned, left office in 1974. So their image of Nixon is a caricature. He's the guy on The Simpsons. He's the classic crooked Paul. He's the mask that every bank robber pulls on before they go in to do the bank heist in Hollywood. And I thought that there, particularly in this time of Trump, there would be an interest. So I tried to make the book an introduction for millennials, X-generation folks who did not have direct experience with Nixon, rather than to join one side or the other in the old left-right argument that the baby boomers have been having since the end of Watergate.
Yeah. You've talked about how these two words kept coming to you in the way you would describe Richard Nixon and his political career, and they were "and yet."
Yeah. The book originally had the working title, Richard Nixon, An American Tragedy.
Yeah.
And we dropped that and went with Richard Nixon, The Life. But I always thought that the two words, "and yet," very much sum up his character. Because every time you say something nice about Nixon, you have to say "and yet,"
yeah,
and refer back to the White House tapes and something terribly ugly that he did. But every time you say something despicable about Nixon or you chronicle some despicable behavior of his, you have to say, "and yet he also did this, this, and this." And the classic case is civil rights in his presidential term, mm-hmm, where Nixon slowed the federal government down and its enforcement of civil rights, tried to appoint Southern judges, dragged his feet on Supreme Court decisions ordering him to desegregate. And yet, when the Supreme Court finally held the gun to his head, he put together a supreme team of George Shultz, Len Garman, and others who went down to the southern states, got community leaders together, and in Nixon's first term did more desegregation of southern schools than any other president had, and even got a majority popular approval rating among blacks in the South. They favored him 43-40% after all this desegregation was over. The thing about Nixon was he didn't want to claim any credit for it because he was trying to lock up the South, according to his Southern strategy. So he tried to do it as quietly as possible. In the same vein, his administration also was the initiator of what we've come to call today affirmative action.
Yeah.
So there's lots of times in that book where you have to say, and yet.
Richard Nixon, of course, did some reprehensible things, of course, and we'll talk about Watergate. We'll get to him scuttling Johnson's peace negotiations with Vietnam, which is something you've uncovered. But I wonder if this exploration of Richard Nixon, did it give you some sympathy for the man or certainly affection for Richard Nixon?
Definitely. Empathy may be the guiding word. Yeah. I went in thinking that he was not necessarily a thoroughly horrible man along the lines of, you know, a Hitler or a Mussolini or a Stalin, but that the caricature was justified.
Yeah.
And in fact, I discovered that he had a lot of very strong selling points, that his policies were much better than I had remembered, and that with certain exceptions, Vietnam and Watergate, he had been a very fine president. We all know about the approach to China, but he also crafted the first nuclear arms treaty with the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War, the height of the arms race. And his domestic policy was filled with things like the establishment of the Environmental Protection Agency or the Endangered Species Act, or cost of living raises for Social Security recipients, or lower voting age, or Title IX. I mean, you can go on and on, and each time this light bulb sort of gets a little bit brighter that, hey, you know, we really don't know the full story about Richard Nixon.
Early in the book, before he, before he loses his innocence to politics, you report that he was given to small kindnesses. He would bring roses to shut-ins. He would give these small gifts of money to people who had fallen on hard times. It was a lovely story about him befriending a disabled fellow student. That's part of the conflicted impression. He could be really lovely, and then he could be dark. I guess there are two parts to him.
Yeah. And I think that's one reason why those who served with him still maintain, for the most part, a steady loyalty and almost a protectiveness about him. He had a horrible way of dealing with his fellow human beings. Everything had to be rehearsed. He was very uncomfortable with spontaneity and small talk. There's a great story about one of his aides being introduced to him in the first time in the Oval Office, and Nixon is sort of caught by surprise, and he stands up from behind the desk and sort of flaps his hand and does some go and never actually says a sentence. And they take the aide out, and he realizes that aside from shaking his hand, he has not in any way at all said hello to his new boss, Richard Nixon.
Right.
So you know, that's the kind of man that he was. He also was chronically insecure.
Yeah.
And this developed into sort of a paranoia. And the paranoia over the years grew deeper as he got into the give and take of very aggressive political tides. And it all ended up in what, and it's not Jack Farrell who's saying this. This is what Henry Kissinger says in his diary or Elliot Richardson says at the time, which is that they were struck at the end at this almost this Greek or Shakespearean tragic figure who just had this flaw, could not overcome it, knew what it was, and yet ended up with the same disastrous result as if he was destined.
He was his own Iago, you said.
Iago to his own Othello.
Othello.
He's always whispering in his ear, I'm not good enough. I'm never going to be loved. There was a very touching letter that I quote early in the book. He wrote from the South Pacific in World War II to his niece. Yeah. And he talks about her dad being the popular guy in the town of Whittier, California, and Richard Nixon being the sourpuss brother. And that's pretty much the way he saw himself, and that's the way he saw other people seeing him.
It seems like he could never just accept that things had gone well, that he had done something well. You quote Kissinger, who said, "There was no moral to the tale except how easily it could have been otherwise for Nixon." He was never certain that he had earned it.
There are times when, as you study the man, you want to grab him by the lapel,
yeah,
and just say, "Nick, you did good." Classic example is he and Kissinger, they come back from China. It's Nixon's great, undeniable, historic triumph, one of the things that he'll always be remembered for. And they're in the Oval Office, and Nixon feels the urge to denigrate his own performance. And he starts talking very cynically to Kissinger, saying, "You know, Henry, the American people, they're a bunch of sheep. They're suckers. They were easily fooled by all that handshaking stuff over in Beijing. And, you know, you and I know it. None of it means anything." Sad.
Yeah, really sad. Let's talk about his childhood, because I think this seems to help explain in some ways. Although he never was given to and he never saw a therapist, for example. But you have to go back, I think, to his childhood. His father, Frank, seems like a crotchety guy, kind of miserable and creepily horny, I have to say, too. That was a very weird part of the story. I'll let people read that. But he grew up, you write about the emotional and physical severity of the house in which he grew
up.
Yeah.
Well, first of all, Frank, his dad, had very little education. He was a sixth grade dropout. He had sort of roamed all over the West doing odd jobs before ending up in Europe, Linda, California, where he managed to fail at growing lemons in the world's most bountiful citrus territory, and was outspoken. He was a blowhard. There are hints of certainly emotional abuse, if not physical abuse, in the family. And his mother, what came from sort of Quaker gentility there in Southern California. Right. But she was the kind of woman who would retreat to her closet to pray. And as Richard Nixon famously said, "Never in my life did my mother ever tell me that she loved me."
Yeah.
He had, in addition to that, the family had the golden-curled younger brother, Arthur, died of from meningitis in a week of suffering. And Nixon's older brother, the eldest of the family, the best and the brightest, as his father was always telling him in Dick's hearing, died after a long 6-year struggle with tuberculosis that totally consumed the family's emotional energy and its financial resources and kept Nixon from going to an Ivy League college, even though he had the grades and the invitation to apply. So all that left a person with deep grievances and very suspicious of folks like John Kennedy, who seemed to have everything, who had good looks, who were dashing, who came from a famous wealthy family. And Nixon had none of that.
Yeah.
No political machine. He did it all by himself. That's one of his great strengths. He did it all alone, did it all by himself. Amazing perseverance and resilience.
Whittier is an interesting place. There's this great quote you include in the book by the food writer M.F.K. Fisher, who said that in her time there with the Quakers in Whittier, none of the friends, no one had ever invited her into her house. And she sort of comes up with this conclusion that they're a bunch of sanctimonious bastards. but what was the effect of his mother's Quaker beliefs on Richard Nixon, because his affection for peace, his desire for peace, seems important?
Well, he desperately wanted his mother's love. He wanted her love and her attention and didn't get it. She was busy with the store, busy with her brothers, and or busy with her faith. The Western Quakers are a little bit different from the Eastern Quakers in that the Eastern Quakers are more relaxed and pacifistic and more interested in social justice than the Western Quakers. But the Western Quakers still have that great impulse for peace. And Nixon saw that if he could get into politics, if he could accomplish great things in international relations, that he could win his mom's approval. Mm-hmm. And actually, what's amazing, one of the amazing stories I came upon was Richard Nixon, in his first term as a member of Congress, risks it all by supporting the Marshall Plan.
Yeah.
in a very conservative district where he was getting letters from his closest supporters saying this is money being poured down a socialist rat hole. Don't do it, Dick. Threatening him, don't do it, Dick. And Nixon went over to Europe, saw that the Marshall Plan was needed, and came back and made this courageous decision that he was going to persuade his district. And he went from one end of the district to the other, speaking at the Rotary Club, speaking at the churches, and telling folks that this was a great plan, it was desperately needed, and sold them on his brand of internationalism. So one of his great first triumphs, overlooked for many, many years, was sort of out of this obligation to his mom to seek peace.
You said his experience, and you write about his experience, his service in World War II. Which, and maybe this is a bit of a sidebar, but it's interesting how, and you talk about this later in the book, how in 1960, when he's running against John F. Kennedy, the liberal press really talks up John F. Kennedy's service in World War II and completely undermines Richard Nixon's service, even though they had similar experiences, the two candidates, in World War II.
They were in the same battle zone,
yeah.
Along with, parenthetically, Joe McCarthy, Washington Post editor Ben Bradley.
Yeah.
There are a lot of famous people went through it was made famous by the Broadway show South Pacific. And the Solomon Islands campaign was grim. And that's where Kennedy's torpedo boat ran into a Japanese destroyer. And Richard Nixon was there constantly pushing the Navy to move him up the chain towards the front. He was in charge of a combat transport team that took the wounded out and brought ammunition and food up to the guys fighting on the front. His tent was destroyed by Japanese shelling. They were periodically bombed by the Japanese. So he was in the action, but compared to the great myth of PT-109, it was downplayed and even got worse than that, in that a lot of people took the fact that Nixon did well playing poker when he was
right.
In the combat zone and made it sound like he had spent the entire war playing poker in Washington or Philadelphia, which wasn't true at all.
Yeah. But you mentioned that, again, that peace-loving, that the war for Nixon he saw as a catalyst to really work for peace, and I think that's interesting. And talk a little bit about his ideology. There were progressive elements to it, certainly a realism, it seems.
Yeah, his first campaign, two things were notable. One is that the campaign slogan was Richard Nixon is one of us,
yeah.
Meaning that he identified from the very beginning with that sort of middle-class, working-class Americans that the Republicans really at that time were not identified with. They were thought of as the party of Wall Street. And so you can see the beginnings of what came to be called his silent majority. Mm-hmm. Very similar, actually, to Trump, who actually used the phrase silent majority
yeah.
last fall.
Yeah.
And then the other thing about his first campaign was that he described his ideology as practical liberalism, which meant a reaction to the New Deal. We're not going to go overboard, but hey, folks, you know, we do need to cut back on some of these regulations and this regimentation that you've experienced in the war. But practical liberalism, he meant both parts. He meant both the practical and the liberalism.
Yeah.
And he turned out to be a very, what we would call, very liberal president today, even though at the time he was seen as a sort of moderate Republican.
Yeah. That's John Farrell. His new book is called Richard Nixon, The Life. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the journalist and historian John Farrell is joining us to take us through his new biography of Richard Nixon, where he describes a ruthless and brilliant man, also idealistic and progressive. The book is called Richard Nixon, The Life. I want to come back to something you mentioned earlier, his brother, Harold, who died.
Yep.
And you report in the book that Nixon was, as you put it, locked in agony over it, but he didn't let it out. And it was around this time he took this philosophy course, and I wanted to ask you about it because you described this as a time when he field-stripped his faith.
Yeah, Nixon was raised in a Quaker environment, went to church all day Sunday, two or three services, and also to midweek services, sang in the choir, went to Sunday schools that even his father taught. So it was a very religious household that taught the fundamentals. Yeah. So that he believed, for example, that Jonah had been swallowed by a whale. Right. And then these terrible things begin to happen to him, and they occur just at the time when terrible things are happening in the world with the rise of the Italian governments after World War One. And at the time in any person's life when they are looking around and they're questioning their beliefs. And so he had this philosophy course where he was required to keep a journal, and the journal spells out how over the course of a year his former rigid conservative religious beliefs are now changing, and he becomes much more where he believes that before there had been an intervening God who answered prayers directly, he becomes to believe that yes, the universe is ordered by a divine spirit, but not one that interferes with human affairs or who can be talked to and summoned. So it was vaguely a deist approach, which is what, you know, Jefferson and Franklin had. So it was firmly within the American tradition. And pretty much from that point on, he stays with this religious point of view, thinking that our work here on the planet is our own to do, and that we're not going to be able to just get on the hotline to heaven and summon divine intervention. Mm.
Let me ask you about that first political race that he runs. He's enlisted to run against an incumbent, a Democrat named Jerry Voorhees. And I want to ask about the strategy that he seems to hit upon when he goes to Washington to talk to Republican Party officials. And he gets this this line of attack, as you describe it, this guilt by association. I mean, Voorhees, his views are tilted left, you say, but he comes upon this idea of sort of associating Voorhees with the communists. And he figured he could win if he portrays him as a red dupe. Is this his first kind of inclination to do this kind of dirty campaigning?
Absolutely. It shows right from the beginning. Before we get to the red part, you know, Nixon was somebody who sat in a chair with yellow legal pads and wrote down all the things that he had to do. And so he would write down, you know, make appointments to campaign at the Rotary Clubs, buy signs for lawns and stuff like that. At the bottom of one of these lists, he had written, put spies in Voorhees' camp. So he had a long, long, long time before Watergate, he had this inclination for political skullduggery. And but it most famously evidenced itself in that 1946 race by his tainting of Voorhees as, if not a communist dupe, yeah. Which was somewhat ironical since Voorhees' only great legislative accomplishment had been the Voorhees Act, which was a clampdown on communists during World War II. So there's no way in the world you could accurately portray him as a red. But Voorhees was backed by the unions, and the unions were very aggressive coming out after World War II. And some of them were subject at that time to real communist and socialist influence. And so Nixon tied Voorhees to the unions and the unions to the communists. And that's how he made that argument in that race.
I can't tell if it was Nixon who was driving this kind of strategy or if he was also influenced by others. I mean, you mentioned there's a man named Murray. Is it Schottner?
And it was around. I mean, in the 1946 campaign, this was a Republican Party strategy all throughout the country. So it wasn't just Nixon. And,
sure.
And even if you go to John F. Kennedy's campaign rhetoric from that fall when he came back and was running, he was speaking to the conservative Irish Catholics of Boston about the evils of communism. So, not unique to Nixon whatsoever, but definitely. The turning point of that campaign was a one-on-one confrontation in a debate in which Nixon and Voorhees clashed over this issue.
You say it was around this time, the 1946 campaign, that Nixon begins to brush Pat aside. And I want to ask you about that because you say they're a team for a while. They enter the race as a team. But Nixon, he's got these you know, pretty dated views about women. Politics was a man's job. I'm wondering how this influences their relationship. They seem to be pretty close, but I can't quite tell.
Well, they were never as close, I don't think, as they were before that, before he got into politics. Pat did not at all like what it did to him and what it did to her family when they eventually had the two girls. And she was always complaining about what she called this politics thing.
You do include the quote, though, of Nixon. This is later when he says to someone, "I don't have a lot to talk about with my wife at dinner."
No, I mean, it was the relationship gets very strained and awkward at different times, as many marriages no doubt do.
Yeah.
But the Nixons would communicate, not just he and Pat, but also he and his daughters. They would communicate by slipping, you know, notes under each other's doors at night, rather than having good heart to hearts. And in her biography of Pat Nixon, Julie Eisenhower, their daughter, yeah. Julie Nixon Eisenhower, writes about how both her father and her mother were emotionally stifled by the cruelties of their childhood, and that was the great. No, not crime, but it was a great tragedy of their marriage, was that neither one, so desperately in need of talking and sharing with the other, could bring themselves to do it.
Let me ask you about Nixon's views on race, which you were talking a bit about. They're obviously conflicted. He thought Jews were obnoxious, that the Irish were mean drunks, that Mexicans were thieves, that black people were inferior. Was he different at all from white men of that generation, or was this pretty typical?
I think it was pretty typical, except for the fact that the tapes capture a special ugliness when it comes to Jewish opponents.
Yeah.
I'm talking about the White House tapes now. We're flash forwarding.
Yeah.
And there seems to be something there. I think most likely it came from his dad, who ran a small grocery store from a converted church out on the crossroads outside of Whittier, and always suspected that the big chain stores, which were run by the Jews, were undercutting him unfairly. And then Nixon gets into politics, and he finds that the Eastern liberal press, is run by, or not run by, but in two important cases, the Washington Post and the New York Times, are owned by major Jewish families who are constantly battling what he stands for, and favoring Kennedy, favoring Adlai Stevenson, going after him on the Pentagon Papers and on Watergate, and his paranoia mixes with his bigotry, and it is incredibly ugly, the things that come out on those tapes.
You also say Nixon put his thoughts about race on paper at the end of his first term. He actually writes some of this down.
Yeah, I stopped the narrative of the book several times just to talk about Nixon's evolution on race, because one of the great surprises to me was how enlightened he was on race in the 1950s. Now, part of that was political expedience, because he was looking ahead to running for president and knew that he had to be able to get black votes in the northern cities. But Martin Luther King thought he was a great ally. And in the 1957 Civil Rights Bill, in the battle in the Senate, Nixon made two very courageous rulings at a time when Lyndon Johnson and John F. Kennedy were dragging their feet to appease the South. Nixon was out there battling for Martin Luther King, and Martin Luther King wrote to an inquiring journalist that it is quite possible that Richard Nixon doesn't have a biased bone in his body, but if he does, he's so good at cloaking it that he could be the most dangerous man in America.
Yeah.
Then you get to 1960, and Nixon, for the first time, sees the potential, the ability to get Southern votes. And Martin Luther King is arrested in Georgia at a protest. And the Kennedys intercede to comfort his wife, and they intercede with the judicial system in Georgia to get him released. And the Nixon campaign issues a cold no comment.
Yeah.
And from that point on, Martin Luther King said, okay, he revealed himself. He doesn't have the moral character. But then even in his presidency, as we talked before, he tried to do good out of sight, behind this storm of semi-racist rhetoric about busing and the South being put upon. Very quietly, his administration was doing good things.
What effect do you think his no comment, saying no comment, had on the race? Nixon said that he would have won if he had 5% more votes in black areas. Was he right?
I think so. I think that there were so many factors in that race that to pick one and say, you know, that was it. I mean, there were allegations of cheating on election night.
Yeah.
There was this notorious episode in Dallas where Lyndon Johnson was set upon by a bunch of Texas conservatives who spat on Lady Bird and may have swung Texas to the Democrats at the last minute. But the most important thing, of course, was the first great debate in which Kennedy clearly triumphed, in part because Nixon's luck had finally run out, and he was ill. He was a sick man that night, and looked it.
Well, he'd spent 12 days in the hospital, I think you said.
Yeah.
Right before that.
Yeah, he'd got an opportunistic infection in a battered knee, and came out looking gray and wan, and his collar didn't look like it fit him.
Yeah.
And then he reverts back to his college debating days, and he's trying to score these little points against Kennedy. And Kennedy is looking into looks like $1 million. He's looking into the camera, and he's reciting his campaign themes eloquently without any pause and really paying no attention to what Nixon is saying at all.
It's interesting. John Kennedy and Richard Nixon were, I don't know if you could call them friends, but certainly.
Oh, definitely.
Most yeah,
definitely.
Yeah. I mean, it's for a time. I mean, Kennedy thought that Nixon had a keen mind, that he was the kind of man he said the country needed. I mean, they had demanding fathers, you say. They had
cold moms.
Cold moms, death of siblings. So they shared some attributes.
And they admired each other's policies on international affairs. Jack and Jackie invited Dick and Pat to their wedding.
Yeah.
Yeah. And it all sort of fell apart with that 1960 race, and Nixon came away very resentful of the Kennedys and determined that he would, as his daughter Julie told me, determined that he would never be out-cheated again.
Yeah, a consuming resolve, never to
yes,
be outdone,
definitely.
You said, by dirty tricks. But let's talk about the dirty tricks. It went both ways. Hoover had the FBI spying for Nixon. Nixon's campaign tried to exploit Kennedy's health. But then Kennedy, you know, he wasn't above doing dirty tricks either.
No, I think there's convincing evidence that there was chicanery in both Texas and Illinois. Both states were carried by the Democrats. Whether or not there was enough to overturn both states is a question that will never be answered. And even if that is true, whether or not there was Republican chicanery in other states like California, that a national recount would have found. The only state that there was a full recount was Hawaii. And that ended up flipping from Nixon to Kennedy. So, you know, the sort of works both ways. And Nixon had no way of definitively proving it and believed that at the height of the Cold War, the United States could not be seen as rudderless. And to his great credit, not only dropped the challenge, but presided over the meeting where college votes are announced and carries it off with just great aplomb. Very few moments like that. It must have been a terribly painful moment, and yet his patriotism and his class showed through.
The tightest election in American history. He lost by less than 1%. Kennedy took Illinois by 9,000 votes. Sounds like you don't want to necessarily say, but what's your hunch? Did Nixon win that race?
I think so.
Yeah.
Again, the problem is that because the Democrats won, all the scholarly and journalistic focus has always been on how they cheated.
Sure.
Whereas nobody has looked anywhere else, like downstate Illinois or the rich precincts of Texas, to see whether there was cheating going on as well there. The vote totals are certainly close enough. I think it was 9,000 votes in Illinois and maybe 40,000 votes in Texas, that it didn't take a lot to swing those states. But would a thorough recount have changed things? The only really in-depth scholarly examination was of Chicago and came to the conclusion that there was widespread cheating going on, but that it was you could not prove that Nixon was cheated out of Illinois.
Yeah. Well, and then for Nixon comes 1962, and Bob Haldeman thought that was even more shattering to Nixon than 1960.
Yeah, he runs for governor to sort of stay alive in the national scene. It was a job that he didn't want. Yeah. He campaigned poorly. The governor of California, the October missile crisis happens right before the election, and all the attention is switched away from that campaign. And he has nursed this grievance that the California press has turned on him. And he gives this amazing press conference, the so-called last press conference, in which he says, you know, you don't have Nixon to kick around anymore because, gentlemen of the press, this is my last press conference. And indeed, he leaves politics for 6 years. He calls them his wilderness years. He leaves California. He moves to New York. But almost immediately, he begins to plot his latest comeback, one of several. Yeah. The guy's middle name should have been Resilience, not Milhouse.
Yeah. Well, of course, in 1968, he becomes president. He takes office. This was so interesting to me. I hadn't realized it. I'm sure I'd read about it before, but he takes office with 43% of the vote. Of course, this is a three-way race. But just enough. Maybe say something about that. So New York, Pennsylvania,
he did not govern like somebody with 43%.
Yeah.
He was bold from the get-go. Right. I mean, within the first couple of weeks, a series of things happened. And, you know, there's the big Santa Barbara oil spill. And all of a sudden, within a year and a half, you've got this amazing Nixon environmental program being pushed on Capitol Hill. You've got him bringing in Daniel Patrick Moynihan to redefine welfare. You've got his first communications with Kissinger about how are we going to open up China. So he definitely did not govern like he was just somebody got in by a whisker. He governed with great audacity.
I want to come back to that, but I want to back up just a bit because we have to say something about this critical moment, something you've uncovered, and resolved this question that's been hanging out there for decades. Did Richard Nixon, in fact, scuttle President Johnson's peace negotiations with Vietnam? And now Nixon denied it. He always denied it.
He did.
But you found this note in Bob Haldeman's notes that really confirmed that, in fact, he had. Talk about this.
Sure. Lyndon Johnson very much wanted to end the war in Vietnam before he left office in 1968. And he got encouragement from the Soviet Union, which said that to help Hubert Humphrey, who was Johnson's vice president, was the Democratic nominee, that they would pressure North Vietnam to engage in what they called productive talks. And so Lyndon Johnson, in return, scheduled this halt in the bombing in Vietnam. And he thinks things are moving along well. And all of a sudden, he gets word that the South Vietnamese are dragging their feet. They're not cooperating with the peace effort. And B, that there's someone from the Nixon campaign, a woman named Anna Chenault, who is talking to the South Vietnamese and telling them to drag their feet. Nixon's going to win and you'll get a better deal afterwards. So he confronts Nixon elliptically on the telephone, but they do have a conversation. And Nixon denies it up and down to Lyndon Johnson. He's asked about it. It's rumored. It comes out. Although most of the documents are sealed up and put away for 40 years. Rumors of it come out, as you said, and Nixon is asked directly about it by David Frost in the famous Frost-Nixon interviews. And again, he says, no, I had no idea what Mrs. Chenault was doing. I would never have done something like that with so many lives at stake. And what I found was a set of notes. Haldeman would go in and take notes as Nixon issued orders. During the campaign and during the presidency. And he would write down Nixon's orders, and then he would put a check mark next to them when they had been carried out. And in this case, there's Nixon saying, keep Anna Chenault working on the South Vietnamese, and then telling Haldeman, any other way we can monkey wrench Johnson's initiative. Now, to his defense, Nixon suspected this was another Democratic dirty trick. He didn't know how sincere the Democrats were treating this opportunity and how much they believed they could actually get peace in the fall of 68. And also in his defense, the South Vietnamese and the North Vietnamese proved to be such stubborn people that it's probably unlikely that there would have been a huge breakthrough in 68 as well. But as a biographer looking for signs of a person's internal compass and his character, I thought this was reprehensible that he would interfere with a peace negotiation that could end a war with all those lives that were at stake. And, of course, the war dragged on. There were 20,000 more American casualties and hundreds of thousands of Asian casualties.
You think it's worse than Watergate?
I think so. I mean, Watergate was a case of Nixon taking all the political tricks that everybody else had carried out since the end of World War II, and doing them, you know, escalating, and doing them clumsily and getting caught, and then covering it up, which is the obstruction of justice that justified him resigning office. But, you know, like the old saying went, nobody died at Watergate, and an awful lot of people died in Vietnam.
John Farrell, his book is Richard Nixon, The Life. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the journalist and historian John Farrell. We're talking about his book, Richard Nixon, The Life. It seems like I'm trying to identify what the turning point is that leads to Watergate. And it seems like there were a number of different moments. 1970 is you describe it as the year Nixon falls apart. What's happening here? Because there are a number of kind of crazy stories.
Yeah, Nixon got a very long honeymoon. And it wasn't until September of 1969 that all of a sudden, well, students came back on the campuses and the anti-war protests picked up with these massive demonstrations in Washington in October and November of 69. And so he's going into 1970. And he decides that in order to win the war, to bring what he called peace with honor in Vietnam, he had to expand the war. He had to expand the war and go into Cambodia and wipe out the supply bases that the North Vietnamese were using. And so this, although in Nixon's mind he's doing this to bring a rapid end to the war, this seems to the American people, the foes of the war, like an expansion. He's going into a neutral country. And the effects on Cambodia of both American bombing and these intercessions were awful. I mean, they 10, 15 years down the line, they helped lead to the genocide in Cambodia and the rise of the Khmer Rouge. So it was a very, very tense time. You had strikes on campuses around the country. You had the incident at Kent State where four students were shot and killed. And then the pressure gets to Nixon so much that he leaves the White House at 4 o'clock in the morning with just one aide. He goes down to the Lincoln Memorial where the anti-war protesters are camped out for the night. And he tries very awkwardly but sincerely to reach out to them and try to reason with them and to convince them that he really does have peace with honor in the back of his mind. And he leaves them and he goes up to the Capitol with his valet and he tries to. He puts his valet on the speaker's platform, and he sits in the audience. And then they're leaving the Capitol, and he meets this cleaning woman who has a Bible, and he starts talking to the cleaning woman about Nixon's mom, who had died a few years previously. And he gets all choked up, and he says, "My mother was a saint. She read the Bible all the time. You be a saint." So there's all this jumble of stuff going through his mind in 1970, from that point on, it's Nixon against the world. Yeah. A polarization brought around for the sake of political gain.
Haldeman says in his diary, "I'm concerned about the president's condition." Can you say anything definitive about his mental health during that time?
I don't think you can. Nixon was always, you know, very high strung. He was a terrible drinker. He was always very much influenced by just one or two drinks. He was taking various mood-altering pills to help him sleep at night, and he could nod off in the middle of phone conversations, leading the people on the other end of the line completely crazy, thinking that he'd had a heart attack or something, and summoning the Secret Service to go rushing into the room and find out what happened to the president.
Yeah.
But the pressure increasingly ratcheted up, and for somebody who was so alone, he had so few emotional allies to rely on. It was too much. And by 1971, you have the leak of the Pentagon Papers, mm-hmm. which, even though they don't implicate the Nixon administration whatsoever, he takes as a mano a mano fight with the left and tries to stop publication, gets into this big battle with the New York Times and the Washington Post. And that's when he calls in this bunch of freelance buffoons mm-hmm. to do what J. Edgar Hoover and the FBI had done professionally for previous presidents, which is burglarize and bug. Yeah. But Nixon brings it in-house. He brings it into the White House, and their first assignment, they bungle, and they are treated with a classic bureaucratic solution, which is we're going to promote him and make him somebody else's problem. And they're sent from the White House over to the Nixon reelection campaign, and that's where they get caught breaking into the Watergate.
You say Nixon, well, I'm not sure if we know. Did he know beforehand about the break-ins? I mean, you say that the tapes make him sound baffled about it.
That's specific. I mean, Nixon, if he'd had line supervision, would never have allowed this particular group of clowns to do what they did.
Yeah.
But the tapes do show him telling Bob Haldeman, Bob, we need to start bugging now. Right. We need to start surveillance now. And encouraging this and creating this mood. So Bob Haldeman's own verdict was that Nixon didn't know about the Watergate break-in, but Nixon caused it.
Yeah. How did he react when he found out? I thought this was interesting. Some said he shrugged it off. Chuck Colson said he was so angry he threw an ashtray.
Yeah, he threw an ashtray across the room. I think that's probably the more likely scenario. He would have been furious right away. But on the other hand, you know, within week one, he had ordered the cover-up to commence, and he had gone off to Camp David where he spent the weekend drawing up lists of the greatest baseball players of all time. So he had that ability to compartmentalize at least
right,
that much.
Right. What did he know and when did he know it? John Dean said Nixon knew it all, and he knew it all along. Is that
he
right?
He did. Yeah. Absolutely. Again, the tapes, there's a reason why he fought so hard.
Yeah.
To keep the tapes, and they are this invaluable historic resource for people like me, and it's too bad that we won't have them in the future. I think that diaries and letters and tapes have all proven to be too dangerous for presidents to keep around. But the tapes constantly show Nixon, you know, talking about who's committing perjury and what about the hush money. And I hope they were smart enough to launder that money. Maybe we have to give these guys clemency. I mean, it went on and on and on.
Say something, if you will, about that final speech Richard Nixon delivers to the White House staff on that final day of his presidency.
I think it's one of the greatest moments in American political history. Maybe even American history, period. I mean, you had this person, this tortured person, standing in front of the White House, having to resign, having to give up this great goal that he had spent his entire life in pursuit of. At this last moment, like this, you know, almost like grace from above, grace from heaven, comes this self-recognition. And he says, always remember, others may hate you, but those who hate you don't win unless you hate them. And then you destroy yourself. I can't imagine any more hard-won wisdom than that. And yet that, of course, was the great lesson of Richard Nixon's life. That was the tragic flaw. That was – there it was in front of everybody. And it's on YouTube. You can watch it. You can watch it. It's gripping, gripping, thrilling stuff.
Yeah. It's interesting. In 1994, he meets with Donald Rumsfeld. And he makes some predictions about the future. He had this sharp analytical mind. What did he get right?
I think he got right the fact that the of course this was 94, so we'd had the fall of the Berlin Wall.
Right.
But he got right the fact that this century was going to be different. That you would have eruptions of rather than great power rivalries, you would have eruptions and frictions and small theater conflicts and wars. I hope he wasn't right. One of his predictions was that in some time in this century, in one of these little wars, some country is going to use a nuclear weapon on human beings again. That's sort of the scary part of that prediction. But he was wrong going back in his analysis of Gorbachev and the potential for real change in the Soviet Union. But he certainly was right about China. And I think that will be his great legacy, was willing to identify this split between the two communist giants, which previous administrations had not been able to exploit, to pull China into the community of nations. And I would say that the 50 years we've had of relative peace, meaning no world war, which to a large extent can be, you know, Richard Nixon can claim credit for some of that.
Yeah. Did he foresee the emergence of, obviously not Donald Trump, but the kind of populism that brought Donald Trump to office?
He practiced it. Yeah. I have this vision of him, you know, in his perch in the afterlife, sort of looking up at us and saying, you know, I told you that they'd miss me when I was gone. Look what I've got now. I think he had too much veneration for American history. He was a great reader, writer of books, venerated Eisenhower, and tried to live up to Eisenhower's vision of the presidency as a majestic place. I think he would be put off by the style of the Trump White House.
Yeah. Let me ask you this finally. James Farmer said of Nixon that he was an almost completely political animal, neither moral nor immoral, amoral. But then you also have those who say that while he was this political animal and he didn't necessarily believe in anything, that in his gut was on the right side. What do you think, finally? Do you think that's right?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I think I certainly don't hold back on him when I talk about Watergate or when I talk about Vietnam in the book. But I think I try to humanize him and show that he did have these impulses for the good, and that at times they triumphed, as in China, as in the Environmental Protection Agency. You know, being politically expedient can be a good thing. You know, Title IX was an act of political expediency. He was getting phone calls from Ohio State coach Woody Hayes and from the president of Notre Dame saying, "You can't sign that. It's going to ruin our football programs." And Nixon went ahead and signed it because it was politically expedient to do so. So he was a cunning man. He was a very smart man. He had his limitations intellectually and certainly emotionally. But, you know, I think that over time, his position, he will rise in the list of American presidents, and I think he'll nestle somewhere, if not in the middle, maybe even a little bit above the middle, which is amazing considering he has this black mark of being the only one that had to resign in disgrace.
Yeah. It's John Farrell. His book is Richard Nixon, The Life. John Farrell, thank you very much for taking the time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News, technical direction from Michael Havey, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.